In this lecture, I want to track the trajectory of an idea and to see how that idea encountered opposition as it settled in different sites of the British Empire. I also want to link the trajectory of this idea with those of the people who embodied it, disseminated it, and sought to implement it. The idea is that of a government's office specifically intended for the protection of Indigenous peoples within the colonial world. This shows schematically its trajectory through the empire. This idea of Indigenous protection travelled from Trinidad across the Caribbean, thence to Tasmania. It was refined in Britain, especially in the House of Commons and in Norfolk, with reference to the Cape Colony in South Africa, and was then imported to New South Wales in Australia, travelling finally to New Zealand. Those men who sought to carry the idea of Indigenous protection across the empire were colonial humanitarians, or philanthropists, as they were called at the time. By telling something of their story, I want to emphasise that British colonial cultures and practices were the result of connections between vastly different colonised places and of the mobility of individuals across and between them. As well as fleshing out the historical geographies of empire, though, I also want to challenge nostalgic and amnesiac accounts of the British Empire that overlook two things. First, the opposition that humanitarians and their idea of protection encountered from other Britons. And secondly, the assault on Indigenous cultures that humanitarians themselves encouraged. I think it important to do this because when it comes to empire, the past is still very much with us in the present, and not just because of America's neo-colonising projects in the Middle East. In various sites of the former British Empire, the relationships between settlers and Indigenous peoples of the early 19th century are being re-examined in the light of current political projects. In Britain itself, Neil Ferguson's recent published and televised survey of the empire portrays it as a force for the progressive, orderly modernisation of the world. Far from feeling apologetic about their empire, Ferguson wants contemporary Britons to celebrate its achievements with pride and contemporary Americans to learn from its example. Although coming to more equivocal conclusions than Ferguson, Victoria Wood's recent televised excursion to various imperial sites named after Queen Victoria had a similar goal, to find those legacies of empire in which we, as 21st century Britons, can find solace. If the effects of empire are subject to ongoing revision in Britain today, they are a topic of much fiercer contemporary debate in Britain's most far-flung possession, Australia. The bicentenary celebrations there in 1988 marked the beginning of what have come to be known as the History Wars. Aboriginal peoples, representatives and sympathetic historians argued for a day of sorrow rather than celebration and proved determined to include accounts of Britain's mass murder of Aboriginal peoples in the nation's official histories. A right-wing backlash ensued during the succeeding decade with Keith Windschuttle, the most prolific and uncompromising combatant, accusing Australia's historians of fabricating histories of colonial brutality against Aboriginal people. Windschuttle has sought to scale down estimates of the violent Aboriginal death toll and to blame inherent failures of Aboriginal society rather than British settlers for the destruction of much of Aboriginal Australia. In Britain's other main Antipodean possession, New Zealand, the effects of colonisation are also near the top of the current political agenda. There, the 1840 Treaty of Waitangi, perhaps early 19th century humanitarians' greatest achievement, is seen as the foundation of an ongoing pact between Māori and Pākehā, or white New Zealanders. Contemporary Māori can appeal to the Waitangi Tribunal for the restoration of land and resources that were confiscated from them, subsequent to the treaty's ratification. Although with nothing like the vehemence of Windschuttle's reaction to so-called black armband historians of Australia, there has been a similar backlash to the tribunal and its version of history among conservative New Zealand historians. Chiming with broader Pākehā concerns about Māori assertiveness, they have criticised the tribunal's supposedly one-sided juridical interpretation of colonial dispossession. Although my emphasis in this lecture will be directed at understanding the colonial past in its own terms, given these disparate but connected contemporary debates, it would be naive to separate the past from its configuration in the present. In tracking the trajectory of protection and the journeys of those people who sought to implement it, I want also to challenge those complacent histories that are being used to serve reactionary projects of historical revision in former colonies and in the former imperial metropole. First, I want to talk about this trajectory of the idea of protection, though, and the changing guise that it took as it travelled across the empire. Having helped achieve the abolition of the slave trade in 1807, British anti-slavery activists turned their attention to the emancipation of those already enslaved in the British West Indies. This would be a further 30-year struggle. It would see Thomas Fowell Buxton, Member of Parliament for Weymouth, succeed William Wilberforce as leader of the anti-slavery movement in the House of Commons, and enslaved people in Barbados, Demerara, and Jamaica, initiating major revolts. In response, the British government attempted to improve the conditions in which enslaved people were held prior to their seemingly inevitable emancipation. A complex of new codes was drawn up through correspondence with local legislatures and governors, focusing on the amelioration of slavery. These codes regulated the hours that slaves were forced to work, their conditions of work and housing, the punishments that could legitimately be inflicted upon them, and the terms on which they could purchase their freedom. The former Spanish Empire provided a model when it came to institutionalising slaves' protection. Following de las Casas's recommendations, protectors of Indians had been appointed in the Spanish colonies, and it was in the former Spanish possession, Trinidad, that the office was revived within the British Empire as the Protectorate of Slaves in 1824. Protectors of slaves were subsequently appointed to all the Caribbean Crown colonies. Their role was to enforce the ameliorative codes and to investigate enslaved people's complaints against masters who breached them. Significantly, the protectors were also intended to help prepare enslaved people for their freedom by encouraging their, quote, Christianization and civilization. The Caribbean protectorates established the notion of a white British official acting as humane intermediary between coloniser and colonised, simultaneously preparing the latter for the responsibilities of assimilation into colonial society. The protectors' position was, of course, fraught. Their task was to safeguard the interests of the enslaved, but without challenging the institution of slavery, and also without alienating the slave-owning class upon whom they relied for their social intercourse. The consensus among historians of the West Indies is that the protectors of slaves were willing or able to effect little change in their host societies until the British government defined their composition and powers more rigidly, and this happened only shortly before emancipation rendered them redundant. The notion of protection itself, though, had a significant afterlife. The word that the protectors of slaves used to denote their activities, amelioration, was taken to Van Diemen's Land by Lieutenant Governor George Arthur. Having been quartermaster general in Jamaica, this Napoleonic War veteran and Calvinist evangelical had been promoted to superintendent and commander of British Honduras, also a slave colony. Here, between 1813 and 1823, Arthur was responsible for enforcing ameliorative measures against vehement planter opposition. He also took it upon himself to shield Mosquito Coast Indians from enslavement. He thereby gained the approval of William Wilberforce, James Stephen, the permanent undersecretary at the Colonial Office, and Henry Bathurst, the colonial secretary. It was this approval which ensured Arthur's next promotion to the role of Lieutenant Governor of Van Diemen's Land, now Tasmania. From 1823, Arthur became preoccupied with the fate of Van Diemen's Land's Aboriginal population. The tribes of the island were being rapidly dispossessed by the increasing number of free British settlers joining their convict counterparts in the colony. In response, Arthur translated amelioration from a Caribbean context to a very different Tasmanian one. He encouraged a small settlement of Aboriginal people on Bruny Island near Hobart as a humanitarian experiment to see if they could be, quote, redeemed and reclaimed for Christianity. They would be given land and supervision along the lines of the model villages for formerly enslaved converts in the West Indies. When Arthur advertised among the settlers in Hobart for a superintendent of the Bruny Island settlement, the successful applicant was George Augustus Robinson, a former builder from the East End of London. I could say quite a bit about the imagery here, but I won't. I'll leave it to your imaginations. Robinson wrote that he was, quote, fully persuaded that the plan which Your Excellency has devised is the only one whereby the Aborigines of this territory can be ameliorated. Once appointed to Bruny Island, Robinson came to loom much larger in Arthur's life. By 1830, Aboriginal resistance to settler encroachment and abuse was peaking. Arthur was finding it difficult to rebuff a public voice, as Robinson put it, clamorously raised in behalf of a general extirpation of the unfortunate blacks of this colony. Arthur's attempts to round up the remaining Aboriginal people so that they could be contained on reserve land through the infamous Black Line resulted in the capture of just one elderly Aboriginal man and a boy. Robinson, in the meantime, had been able to embark on an alternative plan that he called his conciliatory or friendly mission. He would employ the Aboriginal people that he had first come to know on Bruny Island, many of whom are depicted here, to travel with him on various expeditions across parts of Van Diemen's Land where independent tribes were holding out, and embark on negotiations with them. These negotiations would result in their removal to a new settlement on Flinders Island. By moving from the amelioration of a few Aboriginal people on Bruny Island to conciliating Van Diemen's Land's Aborigines as a whole on Flinders Island, Robinson provided salvation for Governor Arthur's reputation as a humanitarian and as a governor. One can sense Arthur's relief when in 1832, with apparent sincerity, he told the colonial secretary in London, "It cannot hereafter be said that the Aboriginal people were torn from their kindred and friends. No, their removal has been for their benefit, and in almost every instance with their own free will and consent. They have been removed from danger and placed in safety in a suitable asylum where they are brought under moral and religious inculcation." Robinson came to the notice of metropolitan officials again in 1837, figuring as the saviour of Van Diemen's Land's Aborigines from inhumane settlers in the report of the House of Commons Select Committee on Aborigines. This committee was the product of extensive trans-imperial networking among humanitarians. Buxton had agitated for it, following news from Dr. John Phillip, the director of the London Missionary Society in the Cape Colony in southern Africa, of how Hausa-speaking people had been provoked into launching a war against the colony in December 1834. With his numerous evangelical contacts around the empire, it was clear to Buxton that such provocations were characteristic of settler colonialism in general. His Aborigines Committee's brief was thus to investigate colonial policy not only in the Cape, but throughout the overseas empire of settlement. When Buxton and his intimate circle came to write the committee's report at Northrepps, Buxton's Norfolk retreat during 1837, their reading of Arthur's correspondence from Van Diemen's Land in particular persuaded them that some more formal and efficient mode of protecting the interests of Aboriginal peoples was necessary. With Lord Glenelg, a humanitarian acquaintance of Buxton, in office as Secretary of State for the Colonies, the Aborigines Committee found extraordinary political favour. In the Cape, it led to an official denunciation of British colonial activities as having provoked the Hausa's attack, and it resulted in an unprecedented directive to hand confiscated land back to Hausa chieftains. When Glenelg turned to the Australian colonies, it was George Arthur again, now back in England, who acted as his advisor on the means by which the committee's recommendations might be enacted. Inspired by his previous experiences in the West Indies and Van Diemen's Land, Arthur suggested the creation of a protectorate of Aborigines as a new branch of colonial government. So the experiment of protecting slaves in the Caribbean, which had travelled with Arthur to Van Diemen's Land, would now be transformed, in the context of lessons from the Cape Colony and other colonial frontiers, into an office for the protection of Aborigines on mainland Australia. Glenelg was happy to put Arthur in charge of determining the principles and personnel for the New South Wales Protectorate. Arthur chose Robinson as chief protector and selected four assistants for him. Three of them, Edward Stone Parker, William Thomas, and James Dredge, were Methodist schoolmasters, and the fourth was a former army officer, Charles Whiteman Sivright. This team of protectors was to be sent to the Port Phillip district, surrounding present-day Melbourne. It's this area here. And this was the latest frontier of British settlement in Australia during the late 1830s. I now want to examine how the protectorate idea came to settle and embed itself in one particular colony, New South Wales. The instructions given to Robinson and his assistants charged them with the task of shielding their Aboriginal charges in the district from, quote, cruelty, oppression and injustice, and from, quote, encroachments upon their property, whilst at the same time gradually converting them from their, quote, wandering and barbaric state to one of sedentary Christian civilization. At first, it was envisaged that the assistant protectors would accompany the various Aboriginal tribes in their districts as they ranged across their territories. But ultimately, they would build stations within reserved landholdings, and Aboriginal people would come to them. These protectorate stations, where protectors and missionaries could work alongside one another, would act as model agricultural communities for the salvation, education, and civilization of each district's tribes. It's a commonplace in the historiography of the New South Wales Protectorate, such as it is, that the experiment was a failure. But the question is, according to which measures did it fail and why? When Windschuttle writes of the Protectorate's failure or ineffectiveness, he's not actually referring to its inability to protect Aboriginal people. For him, they generally did not need protecting from British settlers. Rather, he suggests, the failure of the Protectorate lay in its inability to persuade Aboriginal people that they should abandon the cultural and material practices of millennia and convert to British Christian modes of civilization within a generation. An argument, as we will see, which has long antecedents. For other, more generous historians, it was the Protectorate's inability to prevent mass dispossession, murder, and death by disease and starvation that comprises its overall failure. However, too often, the blame is placed on the individual characters of Robinson and his assistants. Robinson, and the image itself conveys something of this, was a bumptious man. He was prickly and sometimes an incompetent administrator, and he was certainly overly protective of his status. It's true that he frustrated the superintendent of the Port Phillip district, Charles Latrobe, as well as Governor George Gipps, with his far from concise reports. In fact, the two senior officials shared a private joke about him, Latrobe writing to Gipps that he would keep his own dispatches brief, as I do not wish to inflict a correspondence a la Robinson upon you. But Robinson felt that he had to make his reports of Aboriginal culture, of settler brutality against Aboriginal people, and of the suffering that disease and starvation were inflicting on his charges as complete and convincing as possible if he was to fulfil his role as protector. His insecurity over status was a direct result of the fact that few senior settlers or officials were willing to forget his lowly working class origins in Britain and his initial colonial career as a builder. For them, his elevation to a reasonably senior appointment was itself an affront. Yet it's not only Robinson himself who is targeted by many Australian historians. Each of his deputies is as well. Parker and Thomas are generally seen as well-meaning but naive. But perhaps the greatest venom is reserved for the assistant who stood out from the others from the first, the former army officer, Charles Whiteman Sivright. Unfortunately, there's no surviving image of him that I'm aware of. And one can by no means claim that Sivright's moral reputation was unblemished. Before his assumption of the post of assistant protector, he'd resigned his army commission to pay off gambling debts and left his wife and children destitute in Malta, dependent on charity from the governor. On the voyage to Melbourne, he'd apparently tried to seduce the wife of his colleague, Parker, and once in post, an argument with his own wife led to her alleging, apparently whilst in a drunken rage, that he had even attempted incest with their daughter, something both wife and daughter later denied. And yet moral and personal failings, even of the order of which Sivright was accused, did not necessarily impede the protector's attempts to perform their duties. To suggest that they did, and furthermore that such failings were the main reason for the protectorate's ultimate closure, is, I think, to collude in the settler discourse that really ensured that closure. If the existing historiography of the protectorate identifies the moral failings of its personnel as one key reason for its ineffectiveness, a second reason often attributed is the naivety of the venture as a whole. The protectorate is generally dismissed as an ineffective gesture towards humanitarianism, while the real processes of brutal Aboriginal dispossession unfolded. Certainly, Governor Gipps himself stated that the course pursued by the protectors had been one from the beginning of feeble action and puling complaint. But he said this in retrospect and in order to exonerate himself from the decision forced upon him by the Legislative Council to wind the protectorate down. This dismissal of the protectorate as an inherently futile gesture deflects the blame for its inability to protect more Aboriginal people. It was not some impersonal, inexorable juggernaut that determined the nature of colonisation in the Port Phillip district and that overcame the protector's endeavours. We need, I think, to do rather more to identify the specific interests and individuals who actively opposed the protectors, who saw to it that they could not fulfil their protective function more comprehensively. It was British settlers, ranging from convict and emancipist stockmen to the most respectable and wealthy squatters the so-called pioneers of Victoria, who marginalised and thwarted the protectors at every turn. The squatters were the colony's major landholders, leasing great tracts of territory beyond the formal limits of settlement for grazing and paying only nominal rents for the privilege. They were able to work these outlying stations with free labour due to the colony's system of convict assignment. Together, these men comprised the most powerful faction in colonial politics. Not all of them campaigned against the Protectorate, of course. There were some who were sympathetic, but most of them certainly opposed it. Although every one of the Assistant Protector's individual stories could be used to make this point, I'll employ aspects of Sivright's story for illustration, precisely because he was the most obviously flawed character among them. When he arrived in New South Wales with his wife Christina, their four daughters and three sons, Sivright was immediately confronted by the unpopularity of the notion of the Protectorate among the colony's squatters and among the stockmen, both free and convict, who seized and maintained Aboriginal land on their behalf. Sivright's fellow Assistant Protector, James Dredge, reported that they had received a chilling reception in the colony, enduring an amount of obloquy which could not well have been exceeded had we been expatriated for notorious offences. The Sydney Herald, the mouthpiece of the squatter class, had greeted news of the Protectorate with mingled dismay and ridicule, claiming that no decent settler would ever assist such, quote, useless officials. As he began his duties in the western portion of the Port Phillip district around Geelong, Sivright was appalled by the viciousness of colonisation. This gives just a rough and schematic view of how rapidly Aboriginal land was taken into the hands of squatters during the late 1830s and early 1840s. Sivright's area consisted of more than half the size of Scotland and was inhabited mainly by the Barrabool people. The Barrabool's game, largely kangaroos and staple yam plants, had quickly been destroyed in the squatters' rush to grab land. Sivright soon appreciated that hunger was bringing them into increasing conflict with other Aboriginal groups whose hunting grounds and significant sites they were forced to intrude upon. On Sivright's station, Barrabool people were soon starving to death. By August 1839, Sivright was writing in his journal, "Their wants, their grievances, their protracted sufferings and lingering death have been reiterated for months, and I am still in the midst of the same scenes, and have not an ounce of food to save them from starvation. I am surrounded by them in the bush, where my family are hourly importuned for the pittance we have it not in our power to grant." Since he couldn't offer the means of survival on his station, Sivright threw his energies during his first year in office mainly into the investigation of the numerous cases of murder of Aborigines by white stockmen. During that first year, he rode over 9,000 miles, visiting the stations of 45 different squatters. He quickly appreciated that Aboriginal people were being killed on an extensive scale by the stockmen who manned the remote runs on behalf of the more respectable squatters. Most of the killings that the Barrabool reported to Sivright resulted from stockmen's sexual relations with and commonly abuse of Aboriginal women. The stockmen also shot Barrabool in order to drive them away from the runs established on their former hunting grounds. Sivright attempted to prosecute stockmen and their employers for both kinds of murder, but generally he pursued them to no effect. His journals and reports detail one after another painstaking attempt to identify settler culprits, collate evidence against them, and conduct their arrest. Nearly all such attempts resulted in a settler magistrate's refusal to prosecute or a settler jury's acquittal of the suspects. In response to his protestations to the Attorney General of New South Wales, Sivright was told that he could not expect much cooperation from the official or settler community when resentment at humanitarian interference in their affairs was running so high. That resentment, stirred by the establishment of the Protectorate itself, had become more vociferous shortly after Sivright's arrival. In an unprecedented and unrepeated court case, pursued as a result of considerable humanitarian pressure in Sydney, seven white men had been executed in late 1838 for the massacre of 28 Aboriginal people at Mile Creek, a massacre depicted here well after the event. After the executions of the seven white culprits, the Sydney Herald had advised colonists to take the administration of what they called justice against Aborigines into their own hands if the governor and his, quote, overpaid Whiggish lawyers dared punish another white man for alleged outrages on blacks. In the aftermath of the Mile Creek trial, Sivright's ongoing attempts to prosecute white men for the killing of Aborigines were constantly mocked. Port Phillip Gazette, for instance, stated that bringing, quote, gentleness or religion to beings who have scarce a sense beyond the brute is but as pearls to swine. Furthermore, paper went on, whilst this charitable doctrine is being preached to them, they may with impunity rob and murder us. The letter concluded with an appeal to Western District squatters to draw up a petition to Governor Gibbs, quote, for defence of what is sacred to us, our pockets. Something that a group of the most respectable squatters in the region duly effected. Now, the odds were clearly stacked against a small band of protectors in the Port Phillip district. However, Sivright and his colleagues did attempt to actively perform, as well as rhetorically perpetuate, a humanitarian discourse in opposition to locally prevailing settler practice. It's no surprise that Sivright was described by one squatter as, quote, the most unpopular man that ever breathed. Not just him, but all of the protectors were persistent in their attempts to prosecute settlers for murder, to preserve at least some Aboriginal land from further squatter intrusion, and to provide medical relief and supplies to dispossessed Aboriginal people. However, their voice was all but drowned out by the clamour of settler opposition. In 1841, 3 years after the Protectorate's establishment, the Geelong Advertiser warned La Trobe and Gibbs, "Let the matter of the Protectorate be taken up vigorously by the local press, backed by the settlers, and the subject will ultimately be forced upon the notice of our rulers and the influential part of the British public through 1,000 channels. We are not without advocates at home, and a hint dropped in the colonies may be picked up in England and made use of in the promotion of colonial reform and the substitution of some sounder system of policy." Picking up on the veiled threat, La Trobe duly noted that the Protectorate had fostered, quote, a spirit in the European residents which it is the most anxious desire of the government to remove. After repeated attempts, the squatter and settler press's unceasing critique of the Protectorate finally gave the squatter-dominated Legislative Council the excuse it needed to institute an inquiry by its own Aborigines committee. Having questioned only the settler magistrate enemies of the Protectorate, the committee concluded that the present system of protection of the Aborigines has totally failed in its object. Some of the evidence shows it to have been useless, while other witnesses state that its effect has been prejudicial to the objects of its care. One letter goes the length of asserting that the protectors had thwarted the efforts of others to educate Aboriginal children. This damning report ensured the closure of the New South Wales Protectorate at the end of 1849. It's clear that the Legislative Council had long been opposed to the continuation of the Protectorate, but the grounds on which it could legitimately ensure its closure are revealing of a second reason, other than settler opposition, for that failure. Throughout its journey from the Caribbean, the notion of protecting enslaved and then indigenous people had been indissolubly bound up with the notion of redeeming and civilising them. Protection and civilisation were two sides of the same coin. Since only once colonised peoples were able to fend for themselves as the civilised subjects of an imperial polity, would they be freed of the need for white philanthropic guardianship? The idea of Aboriginal protection that had travelled from the Caribbean to Australasia via the Cape and Britain was, in this respect, a precursor to later 19th century notions of trusteeship. Success or failure of the idea was predicated on the extent to which protectors were able to achieve the cultural and material transformation of their charges, as much as it was on the extent to which they could prevent their murder and dispossession. And here, the New South Wales Protectorate clearly failed. The most successful of the Protectorate stations in attracting and retaining Aboriginal inhabitants was Edward Stone Parker's at the Loddon Valley. Around 100 Dungurung people were attracted to Parker's station in order to obtain food, blankets and a refuge during the first 3 years of its existence, a time in which Parker tried to combat the local settlers, who had advised him that around a half of the local Aboriginal population needed to be shot for their runs to be safe. There's much evidence in Parker's journals of genuine affection between many of the Dungurung and himself. However, like the other protectors, Parker was intent not merely on offering provision and sanctuary from settlers, but also on Christianising and fundamentally changing his charges. On one occasion, two elders reproached him for interfering with their traditional education of the young, a comment which intriguingly mirrors the Legislative Council's criticisms of the Protectorate. In his last report from the station, Parker admitted, "The mass of the Aboriginal population of this district remains unchanged in their characteristic habits and inclinations, and in some instances I've witnessed more determined hostility to religion, a more inveterate attachment to their own sensuality and superstition than ever." It was such admissions in report after report from magistrates, missionaries and the protectors themselves that the Legislative Council was able to draw upon when justifying the closure of the Protectorate. In the final section, I want to move on to consider the second main colony in which the Protectorate experiment came to settle in New Zealand. The New Zealand Protectorate was modelled on that of New South Wales when there was still the promise of its success in 1840. It arose out of the concern of Buxton's Aborigines Committee that whalers, traders and runaway convicts from Australia, as well as early settlers, were corrupting the Maori before missionaries had had the opportunity to redeem them. Despite the Aborigines Committee's unifying narrative of settler exploitation and oppression in Australia and New Zealand, however, the Colonial Office itself felt rather differently about the two colonial settings. The Permanent Under-Secretary, James Stephen, envisaged that the Maori could be more active participants in their own protection than could Australian Aborigines. When appointing Captain William Hobson as Lieutenant Governor of the new colony, Stephen instructed him that the Maori were, quote, not just wanderers, but a people among whom the arts of government have made some progress, with usages having the character and authority of law. They were thus a people amenable to treaty making, in a way that Australian Indigenous peoples apparently were not. Hobson was told to establish British sovereignty over the islands through negotiation with the Maori chiefs, and to create the Office of the Protectorate as one of his first acts upon arrival in New Zealand. The New Zealand Protectorate would serve in the first instance to shield Maori from acquisitive settlers, whose emigration was now being organised by Edward Gibbon Wakefield's New Zealand Company. Hobson's draft treaty guaranteed Maori, quote, the exclusive and undisturbed possession of their lands and estates, forests, fisheries, and other properties, and included a preemption clause through which the chiefs could sell their land only to the Crown, which would then sell on to settlers and the company, ensuring fair transactions. It was not only the well-intentioned Colonial Office that was capable of making connections and comparisons between Australia and New Zealand during the process of agreeing the treaty. Certain of the Maori chiefs that Hobson had to deal with had visited Sydney themselves, and one at least asked, quote, but will the white man keep his promise? Look at Port Jackson, Sydney, and say, what has become of the natives? When the white man has built his house and we come to his door, will he not say to us, be off? When the missionary Henry Williams translated Hobson's draft treaty for the Maori listeners at Waitangi, it took considerable negotiating skills and, significantly, a Maori translation that differed somewhat from the English version of the treaty to allay such fears. The treaty established the new protectorate as Maori advocate, resolving disputes between Maori and settlers, as well as those between the Maori themselves. It was also responsible for administering the Crown purchase of such lands as the Maori wished to sell. Like in Australia, however, an equally important task was to encourage Maori, quote, education and civilization, thus facilitating their eventual amalgamation with the British settlers of New Zealand. An ability to speak Maori and an understanding of Maori custom were crucial to the job of protector, and the obvious choice was a missionary. Henry Williams knew just the man, George Clark, a self-educated former gunsmith and Church Missionary Society catechist. Clark had himself travelled to New Zealand from New South Wales, where he had been superintendent of the native institution at Parramatta. This school had been established by Governor Macquarie in 1815 as the first government-sponsored experiment in the civilisation of Australian Aboriginal children. Its first scholars were 12 children captured in a punitive raid against the Darug people. Clark had taken over the school upon its move to Blacktown in 1823. Until his journey to New Zealand the following year, he directed his efforts at the instruction of its students in literacy, largely through the catechism. Like all such experiments in New South Wales, within a few years the school was adjudged to have been a failure. Most of the scholars, in the words of the founder's wife, relapsed into all the bad habits of the untaught natives by returning into the bush. After his passage of the Tasman Sea, Clark was relieved to resume missionary duties among the Maori, having not particularly enjoyed his more secular post in Australia. In 1840, he was reluctant to accept the post of Chief Protector in New Zealand, but he relented purely on the grounds that if he didn't perform the role, someone less sympathetic to the Maori might. Like Robinson, Clark had a fluctuating number of sub-protectors, including his son, George Clark Jr. By 1845, his department numbered about 10 persons, including clerical staff and interpreters.
Now, the Protectorate of Aborigines has not received much attention from historians in New Zealand. As in Australia, the office is rapidly dismissed as a failure. It's rarely been positioned as an active participant in a political struggle over the morality and effects of British colonialism. Clark himself generally garners no more than a passing mention in overviews of the 1840s, his personality often being identified as problematic in exactly the same way as with his counterparts in Australia. Sinclair, for instance, describes him as, quote, an indolent and ineffectual man. This was in fact a characterisation that originated with Governor George Grey, who used the description when rationalising Clark's later dismissal. As in Australia, I think we need to identify more clearly what the Protectorate did, those who sought to undermine it, and the grounds on which they did so. The sub-protectors worked at the grassroots level during the 1840s, sorting out points of dispute between Māori and Pākehā, ranging from the ownership of livestock and land to issues of crime and violence. They would act as legal advocates for the Māori if necessary, though much of their work seems to have involved keeping disputes out of court where possible. Their personal relationships with Māori and their knowledge of Māori language and custom, and also of Pākehā language and custom, were crucial in effecting the peaceful resolution of these disputes. They kept in regular touch with the Chief Protector's office by letter and report, and they travelled extensively to investigate complaints. Hobson wrote, "I know Clark's duties are most severe, and his assiduity is most persevering, often undertaking a journey of 200 or 300 miles, every foot of which he is obliged to walk." In a private letter to George Clark Jr., he later claimed that the best proof of the Protector's efficiency is that their bargains with the natives on that most ticklish subject of the alienation of land have never been disputed. I am not a bit ambitious, but I am proud about that. Māori themselves could recognise that as a political institution, the Protectorate stood between them and acquisitive settlers and the company. Ponehēkei, the chief who put up most resistance to the British authorities in the 1840s, apparently said that he would not hurt Clark because, though you are a government officer, you are an officer for the Māoris also, according to your lights. You are not a stranger, and so long as you do not turn soldier or policeman or collector of customs, I do not mind if you are the only representative here of the government in Auckland. And yet, like its counterpart in New South Wales, the New Zealand Protectorate encountered such fierce resistance that it was fatally undermined by the end of the 1840s, and unable to preserve Māori land from confiscation in breach of the Treaty of Waitangi thereafter. In this case, settler opposition was mobilised most effectively by the New Zealand Company and the nascent settler press. In New South Wales, the Myall Creek case had provided a flashpoint for the crystallisation of settler antagonism to the Protectorate. That role was played in New Zealand by two incidents, the first known as the Wairau Affray, and the second involving Honeheke's cutting of the British flagpole at Kororareka, now Russell. At Wairau in 1843, an armed party of company representatives attempted to arrest Chief Tarapraha for burning a hut the company surveyors had erected on land they claimed was theirs. Tarapraha pointed out that the title had not been settled in accordance with the treaty's provisions. In the ensuing fight, 6 Māori and 22 Britons were killed. Some of the British were tomahawked after surrendering when Tarapraha's ally, Tūranga Ita, discovered that his pregnant wife had been shot during the melee. The conflict convulsed settler society in a fit of rage and panic. Clark wrote to the colonial secretary, siding with the Māori. "The only step which I could suggest is to avow in the strongest terms disapproval of the company. I think this concession, humiliating as it may be, that most calculated to heal the breach and re-establish confidence." The new governor, Fitzroy, took Clark's advice and pardoned Tarapraha and Tūranga Ita. The settlers of Nelson, the nearest British settlement, were infuriated. In a special supplement of the Nelson Examiner, Alfred Demet, the later colonial secretary, waxed vitriolic against the Protectorate and Fitzroy. He led a deputation of Nelson settlers to Auckland to press their case against Clark and authored a petition for Fitzroy's recall. In 1845, the Nelson settlers were joined in their outrage by those at Auckland. Honeheke's defiance of British interference at Kororareka had led him symbolically and repeatedly to cut down the British flagpole. Auckland settlers blamed the Protectorate for encouraging his resistance. An Auckland Times editorial proclaimed, "Let every colonist petition for the removal of that monster of mischief, Mr. Gunsmith Clark, the sun of prosperity will never rise upon this miserable country, till a clerk and with him the whole of the protectorate establishment are swept away from the page of our recognition. They weren't afraid of a bit of hyperbole, these settler papers. In the ensuing petition to the colonial secretary, Auckland's residents claimed that the protectors had subjected the dearest domestic feelings of English settlers to the frequent filthy outrages of the natives. We therefore pray that your lordship will cause to be abolished the unnecessary, mischievous and expensive protectorate system. The signatories of this petition and the one from Nelson were soon to get their wish. Fitzroy was recalled and George Grey, former governor of South Australia, was appointed governor of New Zealand. Backing the settlers, Grey reproduced the tactics of the Legislative Council in New South Wales by pointing to the lack of protectorate success in civilising Maori. The office was dissolved and Clark returned to his missionary duties. I'll draw things to a conclusion now. Robinson's failure to overcome squatter and settler opposition in New South Wales and Clark's parallel failure in New Zealand must be seen in the light of humanitarians' broader inability to sustain the momentum that had enabled them to move from the abolition of slavery to the heights of influence that they had attained with the Aborigines Committee in the late 1830s. This had much to do with increasingly effective settler opposition to colonial philanthropy in other colonies, including the Cape, as well as those examined here. Where British settlers lacked the influence on the Legislative Council that the squatters had in New South Wales, as in New Zealand and the Cape, they worked through unofficial but equally effective channels, including petitions, press editorials, books published in Britain, and appeals to family and friends to exercise what influence they could. These separate but connected settler campaigns against Aboriginal protection resonated strongly in Britain, where an increasing number of voters had friends and family settling in the Antipodean colonies. In 1843, an editorial in the Times claimed, under the guidance of a weak and shallow system of deception, kept Aboriginal protection, the philanthropists have blindly and most vilely reversed the proper relative positions of civilization and barbarism, engendering in the breast of the savage a recurrence to the bloodthirsty propensities of their original condition. In the face of settler representations of their flawed characters and their misguided philanthropy that still persist in some contemporary historians' accounts, the bravery and commitment of the protectors themselves should be more widely acknowledged. But we must also recognise that the protectors' failure to combat settler representations more effectively stemmed in part from the ethnocentric evangelical assumptions upon which humanitarian endeavour as a whole was built. When Indigenous peoples refused to become Christian and civilised in the ways that protectors were supposed to encourage, the disillusionment of their supposed benefactors left the notion of protection available for settler appropriation during the second half of the 19th century. Self-governing settler polities proved all too keen to interpret protection as forced assimilation of the kind pursued by Grey and the provided antecedents for Australia's stolen generation, or forced segregation of the South African variety, or as something in between, based on the confiscation of Indigenous peoples' land, regardless of prior treaties, as in New Zealand and North America. I began this lecture by referring to the ways in which the colonial past is still very much alive in the present, in Britain, in Australia, and in New Zealand. So how should this mapping of the trajectory of British colonial protection inform our understanding of empire and its legacies today? I think in three main ways. First, it tells us that we should challenge the tendency to characterise Britain's imperial exploits as a benevolent civilising mission. Whether we nostalgically recreate this impression from a metropolitan perspective, like Ferguson, to a lesser extent Victoria Wood, or claim it as a proud national heritage in places like Australia. Notions of benevolence were indeed central to the specific colonising project of humanitarianism, and humanitarian figures did make sacrifices to try to put benevolent actions into practice. But there were always other, more brutally acquisitive projects simultaneously at play. These projects were just as characteristically British, and they fiercely contradicted the application of humanitarian principles, even if they appropriated humanitarian rhetoric. Secondly, these other British colonial projects turned out to be more powerful than humanitarian ones in the settler colonies. Their victory was marked most obviously in the attainment of settler self-government in the mid-19th century. From this point on, Indigenous protection came to mean something quite different from the principles that men like Robinson, Sivrite and Clark had sought to effect. And thirdly, even the more progressive colonial projects, such as humanitarianism, shared the intrinsic problem of colonial discourses. They conceived of lessons to be taught by Britons and learned by Indigenous peoples, European models to be emulated and reproduced, aspects of our culture to inform theirs, attempts to make there more like here, and disappointment consequent upon a failure to transform. Despite all the changes that the notion of protection underwent as it travelled from the Caribbean to Australia, South Africa and Britain and back again, it failed to escape its underpinning in a conviction of British cultural superiority. For all their identification with Indigenous victims of their fellow Britons, the protectors could not imagine a world in which Indigenous societies could remain intact and be valued. This brings us finally to what Edward Said has called the post-colonial impasse, the suspicion that any humanist universalism is necessarily a product of its location of origin, a projection of power over others, and thus far from universal. Like Said, I hope that this is not always and necessarily the case, but if we are to guard against the suspicion, the intrinsic arrogance, even of progressive or well-intentioned interventions, or even of those which, like Indigenous protection, have multiple sites of origin and global trajectories, needs especially to be borne in mind in our contemporary neo-colonial world. Thank you.